Spots are filling up fast, so register now at asscamps.ca.
Hey there, Kingston. Looking for the latest in arts and culture? Join me, Ellie Sturton, Friday, 3 to 4 p.m. for the Kingston Curator. Featuring interviews with artists themselves, I'll explore what's happening around town. From live music and theater to gallery shows, festivals, and more. Catch it live on CFRC 101.9 FM, stream at cfrc.ca, or listen anytime on the CFRC Podcast Network. The Kingston Curator, your backstage pass to Kingston's creative scene.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! This is CFRC 101.9 FM, www.cfrc.ca, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario.
New York, this is Democracy Now!
Moments ago, Israel launched Operation Rising Lion, a targeted military operation to roll back the Iranian threat to Israel's very survival.
Israel has launched an unprecedented attack on Iran. Nuclear sites, military leaders, and top scientists have been killed. People across the region are bracing for what comes next. We'll speak with Israeli journalist Gideon Levy in Tel Aviv and Iran expert Trita Parsi in Washington, D.C. Then Congressmember Ilhan Omar on President Trump's widening crackdown on immigrants and protesters.
You have the military being deployed in our streets. My God, this is America.
And we look at the Trump administration's dismantling of U.S. aid and what it means for people around the world to lose this critical lifeline.
The biggest donor was by far the United States. And overnight, aid was cut. So one aid organization after the other has left these people. The water is not flowing anymore. The latrines are overflowing. And the last food distribution were months ago.
We'll speak with Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council, and we'll look at a new Amnesty International report on the impact of the cuts. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Israel's military launched a barrage of strikes on Iran overnight, including on the capital, Tehran. Reuters is reporting at least 20 senior Iranian commanders were killed, including the head of the Revolutionary Guards Air Force, Amir Ali Hajizadeh. Six nuclear scientists were also reportedly killed. Earlier today, more Israeli attacks were reported in Shiraz, Tabriz, and the Natanz nuclear site. Israel's military said it's working to intercept over 100 drones launched by Iran. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warned further retaliation is coming. An Iranian news anchor read Khamenei's statement.
The Zionist regime opened its dirty and bloody hand to a crime in our beloved country this morning and revealed its evil nature by striking residential centers more than ever before. The regime must expect severe punishment.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed to continue the attack on Iran, quote, for as many days as it takes. U.S. State Secretary Marco Rubio claimed the U.S. was, quote, not involved in the strikes, while Trump posted on social media, quote, I gave Iran chance after chance to make a deal. The Israeli attacks came as the U.S. and Iran have been engaged in talks over a possible new nuclear agreement. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The UN General Assembly on Thursday overwhelmingly adopted another resolution demanding an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire in Gaza and for Israel to allow the entry of humanitarian aid. The U.S. and Israel were among the minority of 12 countries voting against. This comes as the UN warned of a full internet blackout in Gaza, paralyzing beleaguered humanitarian aid operations across the Strip as Palestinians face worsening hunger amid Israel's ongoing blockade. Landlines were also disrupted after key telecommunications infrastructure was damaged in Israeli strikes. A displaced Palestinian mother in Gaza City described the daily struggle to feed her children.
We lack everything. We lack food, we lack drinks, we lack cleaning supplies, we lack milk, we lack nappies for the children. What should I tell you? We don't have anything. No food, no drink, no life. We are alive only because death has not come yet. Those who have died are relieved, and we die 100 times in a day.
Three activists with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla may face more time in Israeli prison as airports have shut down due to Israel's attacks on Iran. All three activists had been scheduled to be deported today. Two are from France, Pascal Moriera and Yanis Mamedi. Marco van Ren is from the Netherlands. The Freedom Flotilla coalition is demanding both governments find alternative routes to bring the activists home. This comes after six more of the Madleen's activists were deported Thursday. Israeli forces raided the humanitarian vessel Monday in international waters, abducting their passengers. At least two were subjected to solitary confinement in Israeli custody. German activist Yasmin Ajar spoke out after she landed back home on Thursday.
The world must rise. We all have to rise together. I'm pleading to you. I'm begging you. Get up. What is happening in Gaza is not normal for 20 months.
An appeals court ruled late Thursday that Trump can remain in charge of the 4,000 National Guard members deployed around Los Angeles, reversing a court order just hours earlier, which had returned authority over National Guard personnel in California to Governor Gavin Newsom. A three-judge panel will hear the case again on Tuesday. Neighborhood protests have been continuing throughout the L.A. region as federal agents raid more homes and businesses. Protests have also targeted hotels, including in Pasadena and near LAX, the Los Angeles airport, where ICE agents have been staying. Meanwhile, Trump indicated he might ease up on immigration raids at farms and hotels after those sectors expressed concerns over staff shortages. Protests defending immigrant communities against ICE raids have been taking place in cities across the U.S., including New York, Seattle, Chicago, Austin, Las Vegas, Madison, and Washington. This is a protest organizer in San Antonio.
They're bringing up the troops. They're bringing up ICE. People are scared, but they're the ones that should be scared. Because us as a community, we can make a difference.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott said he's deployed more than 5,000 National Guard troops in his state. Meanwhile, the sheriff in Florida's Brevard County warned protesters his officers would kill them ahead of expected nationwide protests this weekend.
If you throw a brick, a firebomb, or point a gun at one of our deputies, we will be notifying your family where to collect your remains at, because we will kill you graveyard dead.
More than 1,800 rallies are planned across the U.S. Saturday under the banner of No King's Day, coinciding with a $45 million taxpayer-funded military parade and 79th birthday bash for Trump. On Thursday, federal agents forcibly removed California Senator Alex Padilla from a press conference held by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem before shoving him onto a hallway floor and handcuffing him. Before he was attacked by the agents, Padilla introduced himself as a senator as he attempted to ask Noem a question on the ICE raids and crackdown on protesters in L.A. Senator Padilla later addressed the stunning attack at a news conference.
If this is how this administration responds to a senator with a question, if this is how the Department of Homeland Security responds to a senator with a question, you can only imagine what they're doing to farm workers, to cooks, to day laborers out in the Los Angeles community and throughout California and throughout the country. We will hold this administration accountable.
The Trump administration has ordered over 500,000 immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to self-deport or face arrest after stripping them of their humanitarian parole status, which authorized them to temporarily live and work in the United States. This comes just weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Trump administration's efforts to end the relief granted under Biden's presidency. Gerline Joseph, executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, said in a statement, quote, DHS is tearing those lives apart, forcing families into chaos. This is not policy, it is punishment, she said. Harvard Medical School scientist Ksenia Petrova was released on bail Thursday after spending 4 months in ICE detention. The Trump administration has sought to deport Petrova, a Russian national, accusing her of criminal smuggling for failing to declare non-hazardous frog samples when she re-entered the U.S. from a trip to France. Petrova is due back in court next week. The Supreme Court on Thursday unanimously ruled in favor of a family whose Atlanta home was wrongfully raided in the middle of the night by FBI agents 8 years ago, allowing their damages lawsuit against the federal government to move forward. In 2017, Katrina Martin, her partner, and her then 7-year-old son were abruptly awoken when a 6-agent SWAT team smashed their front door with a battering ram, detonated a flashbang grenade, and raided the home as they searched for a suspect. Martin described being dragged from a closet where she was hiding and being held at gunpoint before the agents realized they'd raided the wrong home. 2 years later, in 2019, the family sued the FBI and individual agents for the wrong house raid. The federal government is typically immune from such lawsuits. A British man was identified Thursday as the sole survivor of Air India Flight 171, which crashed in Ahmedabad minutes after takeoff. The latest death toll has topped 290 people, including the other 241 people on board the London-bound Boeing 787-8 Dreamliner. It's not yet clear what caused the plane to crash. Just weeks ago, the U.S. Justice Department reached a deal with Boeing, allowing the airline to avoid criminal responsibility for two deadly 737 MAX crashes in 2018 and 2019. In Kenya, protests erupted in the capital, Nairobi, amid mounting anger over police brutality following the death of political blogger Albert Ojwang while in police custody last week. Police initially claimed his death was a suicide. Prior to Ojwang's arrest, he'd repeatedly called out Kenya's Deputy Inspector General, Eliud Lagat, accusing him of involvement in a bribery scandal and being part of the mafia police. Protesters took to the streets as the government presented a much-anticipated annual budget Thursday.
Our first demand is for Lagat to be put in jail now. He should be arrested. Let us forget about the finance bill.
And I'm telling the youth of this nation, we are stronger than before.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has announced 8 new members for the Centers for Disease Control's Vaccination Advisory Panel after firing its 17 sitting members last week. Several of the new advisors have gained prominence for their vaccine skepticism, including against the mRNA technology used in COVID-19 vaccines. The American Medical Association also raised concerns the new panel was selected, quote, without transparency and proper vetting. The Senate voted Thursday to confirm Billy Long to lead the Internal Revenue Service amid revelations Long was involved in a bribery conspiracy involving a healthcare company and that he's received suspicious donations to a defunct campaign fund after he was nominated by Trump to head the IRS. While he was a Missouri Congress member, Long co-sponsored legislation to eliminate the IRS. The group Americans for Tax Fairness warned Long's new authority, quote, signals open season for wealthy tax cheats. The U.S. House on Thursday approved in a 214-212 vote President Trump's request to claw back $9.4 billion in funding for international aid and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds NPR and PBS. Only 4 Republicans voted against the measure, which will freeze $8.3 billion in appropriated foreign aid and $1.1 billion for public media, pending another vote in the Senate. And here in New York, a judge declared a mistrial Thursday in the remaining rape charges against Harvey Weinstein after the jury deadlocked in his rape retrial. One day earlier, the disgraced Hollywood mogul was convicted of a separate sex crime and acquitted on another. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg vowed to retry Harvey Weinstein again on the unresolved charge. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York, joined by Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Nermeen, and hello to everyone in the United States and around the world. Israel's launched a major military attack on Iranian nuclear and military capabilities, killing dozens of top military officials and scientists, along with civilians. At least 200 fighter jets have struck over 100 targets across Iran, including Iran's main uranium enrichment site in Natanz and a nuclear research site in Tabriz. Strikes have also been reported across Tehran, the Iranian capital. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the strikes will continue for as many days as it takes.
Moments ago, Israel launched Operation Rising Lion, a targeted military operation to roll back the Iranian threat to Israel's very survival. This operation will continue for as many days as it takes to remove this threat.
Are include Iran's top military and nuclear leaders, including Hossein Salami, commander-in-chief of the elite Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Mohammad Bagheri, chief of staff of Iran's armed forces, and Ali Shamkhani, a close aide to Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Nuclear scientists Mohammad Mehdi Taranshi and Fayaruddin Abbasi have also been killed. Iran's foreign affairs minister has said the country has a, quote, legal and legitimate right to respond. It's been reported Iran has launched at least 100 drones towards Israel that are being intercepted. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio claimed the U.S. was not involved in the strikes, while Trump posted on social media, quote, I gave Iran chance after chance to make a deal. The Israeli attacks came as the U.S. and Iran have been engaged in talks over a possible new nuclear agreement. We're joined now by two guests. In Tel Aviv, Gideon Levy is an award-winning Israeli reporter and columnist for the newspaper Haaretz and a member of its editorial board. His latest book is titled The Killing of Gaza. And in Washington, D.C., Tritha Parsi is the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and the author of several books, including Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Welcome back to both of you on Democracy Now! Tritha, let's begin with you. Your response to these extraordinary attacks by Israel on Iran.
So far, it clearly seems that the Israelis have been successful in achieving early stages of what they want, which is to take out much of Iran's command and having killed several senior military officials. When it comes to damage to the nuclear program, the attacks against Natanz are one thing, and that's a facility that is no more than 10, 20 meters underground. There's not been any attacks against Fordow, which is about 800 meters underground, and that is something that it does not appear that the Israelis have the military capacity to take out through bombardment. There may be other avenues that they will pursue, and perhaps even the U.S. does not. But what I think is increasingly clear in all of this is that this was not an act of defiance by Netanyahu against Trump, but rather the Trump administration and Trump himself was coordinating this with the Israelis in the hope, apparently, for Trump, thinking that this will actually soften the Iranian negotiating position and enable him to get a deal in which the Iranians capitulate. It remains to be seen whether that is the case. I suspect that the Israeli hope, however, is that the Iranians don't capitulate, that they strike back, and by that, get the U.S. to get more actively involved in the war.
So, Tritha, can you talk about the significance of who has been killed?
So, several of the top people, the head of the Air Force, the head of the missile program, the former head of the nuclear program, several of their predecessors had also been killed in assassinations by the Israelis. None of them at this scale and at the same time. And this, at a minimum, is going to delay an Iranian response to Israel because so much of the top command essentially is gone. Whether they can actually reconstitute it remains to be seen. But in that sense, the Israelis have pursued exactly the same game plan that they had with Hezbollah, and it appears that the Iranians have learned nothing from that, because that's what the Israelis did in Lebanon. They went after the top ranks, and by that, they made sure that much rest of the organization was not capable of striking back or fighting. And once that happened, the Israelis intensified their bombings, which is probably what will happen in this case as well. Once they feel that the Iranians are essentially incapable of responding, they're going to do everything they can to take out as much as possible of Iran's military capabilities, conventional or nuclear.
So you have this tweet of President Trump this morning where he says, 2 months ago, I gave you 2 months. If you can talk about what's going on at the negotiation level, the fact that the negotiations were supposed to be continuing on Sunday, will that be happening? And the level of infiltration of Iran by Israel, what this means to hit so many, to kill so many of the top leadership in Iran, not to mention if you can talk about the significance of Natanz and these other nuclear and military sites that have been hit.
Well, the significance of what has happened at the negotiating table is that originally the Trump administration entered these talks with the red line of only seeking no weaponization. And with that red line, a deal could be made because it would mean restricting the Iranian nuclear program but not eliminating it. The Iranians have agreed to that in the past. They have signaled clearly that they would agree to it again. Something happened, though, and Trump then shifted his position towards zero enrichment, which is the Israeli position, the same position that John Bolton and Mike Pompeo argued for in the previous Trump administration. This then caused a deadlock in the negotiations, predictably. And it appears that that then opened up the pathway for the Israelis to convince Trump that what he needs to do is to allow Israel to go in militarily with the help of the United States in order to essentially soften the Iranian nuclear, negotiating position. I doubt that there will be any talks on Sunday. I think the Israeli calculation is to hope that there won't be any negotiations going forward at all. The Iranians respond, and then by that, making sure that the U.S. enters the war much more fully and openly than what it has been so far.
Well, Gideon Levy, we're speaking to you in Tel Aviv. If you could tell us, you know, what the mood is there. Israel, a state of emergency has been declared in Israel. Additional attacks from Iran are anticipated. What is happening there? What are you hearing?
It's a very intensive emotional mixture. On one hand, there is the fatigue of the last 20 months in which Israel is attacking Gaza on a daily basis, and many soldiers are there. The war against Hezbollah in the north, people are sick and tired. On the other hand, the James Bond sentiment wakes up now to see all those military impressive achievements. Nobody can deny those are impressive military achievements. And this gives some pride to Israelis. Israelis like it very much. Israel is, as you know, quite a militaristic society. And those achievements, killing here and destroying there, without any casualties, obviously, until now, it's a great achievement. But nobody pays attention to the price, the potential price, the possible price, which none of us know what will it be. And above all, there is no very clear answer. Where are we aiming to? Will we bomb every second year another location somewhere in the Middle East? And by this, Israel will continue with the same policy, the same strategy, living on the sword forever? Can't tell you. But right now, people are very proud of what happened and very worried from the retaliation, which might come any moment.
And Gideon, what about your response? You know, there's been some speculation that these attacks, and indeed the success of these attacks in terms of hitting the targets that were presumably chosen, that this will actually bolster Netanyahu's position within Israel in a way that now whatever support for him was dwindling because of his, the continuing assault on Gaza and
the Israeli hostages not having been released, all of them?
You see, we are in a very, very early and preliminary stage. What looks now as a phenomenal success might turn into a fiasco within hours or days or weeks or months. But right now, I'm sure that Netanyahu is much more appreciated than yesterday in Israeli society. I give him the credit. He didn't do it only for domestic politics. This will be unfair to say. His rivals are many, and I'm one of them, obviously. But this was the project of his life in the last 20 years, and now he really implemented it. We should be very careful in judging it because, as I said, it's too early. But obviously, right now, he is really at his peak in popularity, even though there were no polls yet. But sure, what he had done until now will add him a lot of support in Israeli public opinion, no doubt about it.
We're trying to determine, Trita, if the chief Iranian negotiator for the nuclear deal has been killed or severely injured. We're talking about Ali Shamkhani. It looks like he has been killed. He was former head of the Iranian National Security Council. Can you talk about the significance of this?
So he has been killed, as I understand it. He was not the chief negotiator, but he was the chief of the negotiating committee that was coordinating the negotiations between the negotiating team and the Supreme Leader's office. He's a longstanding figure within the Iranian regime of Arab background. And the fact that he was targeted is also further indication that the Israelis were not trying to enhance the negotiations, but rather force either capitulation or an Iranian response that would bring the United States into the war more fully.
And what are the concerns you have about a wider regional war?
Well, I mean, the concern that existed before, of course, was that this would lead to a major escalation in the region, particularly if some Arab states were allowing the United States to use its bases to support the strikes against Iran, which then would likely lead to Iran striking those countries. Oil prices would go up, flow of traffic through the Strait of Hormuz would go down dramatically, and we would potentially see major destabilizations throughout the region. It's not clear whether it's going to go in that direction, particularly if the Iranian ability to respond has been significantly limited by these strikes. And again, we don't know yet because the picture is not sufficiently clear. At a minimum, it will delay a potential response, but it could also make sure that the response is not at all what it could have been or what many expected it would be, including inside the U.S. government earlier on.
And Trita Parsi, you said earlier that the Iran-U.S. talks that are scheduled for this Sunday, June 15th, with Oman's foreign minister and a U.S. mediator, Stephen Witkoff, you don't expect them to go ahead, though indications from the Trump administration seem to be at the moment that they will go ahead. What do you think?
Well, the Trump administration is saying that they want it to go ahead, but whether it goes ahead or not depends on whether the Iranians show up. And again, I think the Trump administration is trying to use these strikes as essentially a negotiating leverage. The question is if it will work out that way or if it actually will prompt the Iranians to significantly harden their position, potentially walk out of the NPT, kick out the inspectors, and move towards weaponization. There's a lot of different—the spectrum is quite wide there, but I suspect that it is quite unlikely that there will be any talks on Sunday. And I also wonder where the Omanis are in all of this, because they probably feel a bit embarrassed because they have done a very good faith effort to actually negotiate a deal. But they agree to that mediation because of confidence that both sides are serious about a deal. It's not so clear any longer as to whether the Omanis or anyone else would be serious about thinking that the administration actually is looking for a deal.
Finally, you told CNN earlier today that this would be catastrophic for Gaza because now all the focus will shift to Iran and the starving, dying children of Gaza will be forgotten. If you could say a little more.
Are you aiming it at me?
If you could say a little bit more, do you see that?
Yeah, sure. Sure, I didn't know you aimed it at me. Sure. I was asked in CNN and other places, and I think this is very important because the world focus will now be only on Iran, and Gaza will be totally forgotten. And Gaza is still a location of bloodbath, a terrible, terrible reality, as I don't have to tell you, viewers. But this continues. By the time we talk now, there were over 100 people killed only in the last 24 hours in Gaza. This will continue now. And if the world will focus only on Iran, this slaughter will continue day after day. And the suffering is unbearable. And we shouldn't forget Gaza, even though Iran is now the main focus. But let's not forget Gaza, because Gaza is really starving and dying, and the suffer should stop at once. I wish Donald Trump would be more involved in Gaza. And if Israel now has this success in Iran, at least stop the war in Gaza, at least make a ceasefire, and without even any conditions, because the reality there is really inhuman, criminal, and unbearable, and we shouldn't forget Gaza.
Chita Parsi from the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist and Haaretz columnist. Thank you both for joining us. Coming up, Congressmember Ilhan Omar on President Trump's widening crackdown on immigrants and protesters. Stay with us.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard for me, no matter where I go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. No, I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road. Long and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Now the rich man took my home and drove me from my door. I ain't got no home in this world anymore. No, I ain't got no home.
I ain't got no home in this world anymore, a rendition by Billy Bragg in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York.
And I am Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C.
President Trump can keep control of some 4,000 National Guard troops deployed around Los Angeles for now. Late Thursday, an appeals court stayed an earlier order to return authority to Governor Gavin Newsom, which had found Trump's federalizing of California National Guard troops was, quote, illegal. Trump has said he's going to do this in a number of cities around the country. A three-judge panel will hear the case again on Tuesday. This comes as immigrant rights protests continue in Los Angeles and mass protests are planned nationwide this Saturday in more than 2,000 cities, towns and villages. People are calling it No King's Day. On the same day, President Trump is hosting a military parade in Washington, D.C. to celebrate his 79th birthday. On Thursday, we spoke about all of this and more with Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. She's the first Somali-American elected to the U.S. House of Representatives and one of the first Muslim women in Congress, along with Rashida Tlaib of Michigan.
As Congressmember Ilhan Omar joined us from the Cannon Rotunda, just a little ways down the road from where I am right now, I began by asking her about the troops in the streets in Los Angeles, the thousands of National Guard, the Marines, and tanks rolling through the Capitol ahead of President Trump's military parade, which is happening on June 14th on his 79th birthday, Abrams tanks will roll through the streets. Some are saying this parade could cost taxpayers up to $100 million. I asked the Congress member to talk about the militarization of the country right now, and also to tie it to her memoir, which is titled This Is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman.
We are in the midst of the creation of a police state where, you know, you have masked armed men who are in plain clothes that are snatching people off the streets, unwilling to identify themselves. You have the military being deployed in our streets. My God, this is America. You have states' rights being disregarded. So, you know, a constitutional crisis that's being created in front of our eyes. And the same week where we have a president who has deployed the military, who are trained to kill our enemies, not Americans, but our enemies, are in our streets. It's the same week that we are going to have a military parade. Can you imagine that image that is going to be coming out of our country? I mean, I grew up in a dictatorship. And I don't even remember ever witnessing anything like that. To have a democracy, a beacon of hope for the world to now be turned into one of the worst countries where the military are in our streets without any regard for people's constitutional rights, while our president is spending millions of dollars propping himself up like a failed dictator with a military parade, it is really shocking, and it should be a wake-up call for all Americans to say this is not the country we were born in. This is not the country we believe in. This is not the country our founding fathers imagined. And this is not the country that is supported by our Constitution, our ideals, our values. And we should all collectively be out in the streets rejecting what is taking place this week.
Representative Umar, President Trump has issued an extremely dire warning to anyone who protests on the day itself, Saturday, in Washington, D.C. This is what he said.
And we're going to be celebrating big on Saturday. We're going to have a lot of, and if there's any protester that wants to come out, they will be met with very big force. By the way, for those people that want to protest, they're going to be met with very big force. And I haven't even heard about a protest, but, you know, this is people that hate our country, but they will be met with very heavy force.
So, Congressmember Umar, your response to what he said, and also this very dangerous point he makes that protesters are those who hate this country.
I mean, I think the person who is in the process of destroying our country should look in the mirror, and that's Trump, and notice that he is the one that has hatred for the values that we have here in America and everything that we have built. The reality is, protest, dissent is constitutionally protected. That is everybody's First Amendment right in this country, and the fact that we have a president that is threatening to use heavy force, which, again, begs the question, is he going to send people, you know, is the police going to be that heavy force? Is the military going to be that heavy force? What is a heavy force? And why all of a sudden are Americans not allowed to exercise their First Amendment rights? And again, this should be alarming to Americans to understand that we are headed towards a dangerous path, and it will be a dark day if we do not stand up for ourselves, for our Constitution, and for our republic.
And Congressman Omar, you've actually been very vocal in another deeply unconstitutional move that the Trump administration has made, namely the picking up and detaining of students who protested the policies of Israel in Gaza. You've said dissent is constitutionally protected, which of course it is, and that what's happening now in the U.S. is effectively a constitutional coup. So if you could talk about specifically what happened to those students, and what role you see the courts playing in dissenting and arguing against what the Trump administration is trying to do?
Yeah. I've been tickled a little bit by the idea that as an immigrant, I care about the Constitution more than many of my colleagues who seem to think, you know, constitutional protections in this country are only for those who are citizens and have not really read or understood that regardless of what your status is in this country, that you have due process, that you have access to constitutional rights. And what we are seeing is people who, you know, write an op-ed saying the genocide in Gaza should end, people who protest, people who have become a spokesperson for young people in college who are standing up, are somehow a threat to our national security and foreign policy. What they are a threat to is the status quo of continuing to do the same thing and being complacent with a genocide that's happening in Gaza with our tax dollars. And I think it's really important to also remember that almost every single person that has been detained, that they did not ship in the middle of the night. The courts have intervened, and including people like Mahmoud Khalil, the courts have said he cannot be deported and he needs to be released. And they have until the 13th of this month, which is tomorrow, to facilitate his release from detention. And, you know, the Maryland man that they took to El Salvador, to that dungeon, he has been returned. And I know that there are pressing charges against him, but the reality of why they returned him is that they understood that they would be held in contempt of court because the Supreme Court said they have to facilitate his return. And so they are fabricating a case in order to save face because they continue to say that they are not able to get him back into the country and quickly realized that they are going to be in trouble. So all this chaos is wasting taxpayer dollar. It is creating chaos. It is jamming up our court systems that have real work in front of them. But it is not doing the thing that they want it to do because we are a constitutional republic and our constitution will hold.
Let me ask you, Congressmember Omar, about what happened on Monday, 75 House Democrats voting in support of a resolution that included a line praising ICE, expressing, quote, gratitude to law enforcement officers, including U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement personnel, for protecting the homeland. You are trying to pass a law that holds police accountable for violence against protesters. I was wondering if you can talk about the bill that you introduced in May, and also the Trump administration's move to lift the consent decrees holding police accountable, including your own home city of Minneapolis.
Yeah, I mean, people who take an oath to serve and protect should be held accountable when they cause harm in our communities. And right now, the only remedy that exists is for a lot of people when police brutalize them is to sue the city and get some money while that police officer continues to be on the force and does not face any criminal charges. Just the fact that you wear a uniform and wear a badge does not mean you have a right to harm people who are out doing, participating in protests. That is their constitutional right to be able to do so. So our legislation gets at that. It is unfortunate that you know, some Democrats keep falling into this trap in supporting legislation because they do not have the ability to stand up for what they believe, and that is why we are lacking credibility as a party, because, you know, when we say we are for the protection of immigrants, that we are for creating a humane immigration policy, that we want to protect our neighbors, and then you have you know, members of the Democratic Party in Congress take that vote that they took, it becomes a little hard for people to believe that we are sincere in the policies that we push for. So I do hope that my colleagues realize that they are causing more harm to the credibility of Democrats when they are wishy-washy on some of these policies than they are doing to help the country secure its borders and have an immigration policy that is just.
That was Representative Ilhan Omar, Minnesota Congressmember. We spoke with her on Thursday. Coming up, we look at the Trump administration's dismantling of U.S. aid and what it means for people around the world to lose this critical lifeline. Stay with us. Lila Downs performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York.
And I am Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has ordered the termination of all remaining overseas employees of the U.S. Agency of International Development, USAID, or USAID, to complete the dismantling of the six-decade-old agency. USAID was an early target of Elon Musk and Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency. Meanwhile, the House voted Thursday to approve President Trump's request to claw back $8.3 billion in previously enacted funding for foreign assistance from USAID and the African Development Foundation. The request seeks to make permanent the cuts to foreign aid already imposed by Elon Musk's Doge. Oxfam America warns those cuts could cause 23 million children to lose access to education, while up to 95 million people could lose access to basic health care, potentially leading to over 3 million preventable deaths per year. This comes as researchers at Boston University estimate the Trump administration's massive cuts to the U.S. Agency for International Development have already led to some 300,000 deaths. Billionaire Elon Musk called on Trump to shut down USAID earlier this year.
And USAID is a ball of worms.
Mm-hmm.
There is no apple. Mm-hmm. And when there is no apple, you've just got to basically get rid of the whole thing.
For more on the dismantling of USAID and what it means for people around the world, we're joined now by two guests. In Oslo, Jan Egeland is with us with the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's just returned from a trip to Mozambique. And here in New York, we're joined by Amanda Classing, National Director of Government Relations and Advocacy with Amnesty International USA, which has just released a report titled Lives at Risk: Chaotic and Abrupt Cuts to Foreign Aid Put Millions of Lives at Risk. Welcome to Democracy Now! Amanda Classing, let's begin with you. If you could outline the main findings of your report, the effects of these U.S. aid cuts.
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to make sure that there's a full
accounting of the impact on lives around the world. And in the immediate term, we wanted to give a preview of case studies in 12 countries. What does it look like for there to be such chaotic and in many ways cruel cuts to programs? We looked at programs in Haiti where services for children that have been victims of sexual violence by the gangs, they're not able to access the funding that they were going to provide for, in particular, girls. Or they aren't able to continue the prevention and services for people living with HIV that are LGBT or sex workers that have been displaced by gangs. We also looked in countries like Afghanistan, where internally displaced services for internally displaced people have been cut dramatically, and it's leading to women not having access to safe spaces, people losing jobs, including women, the very few jobs left for them. We looked at Yemen, which is one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world, and looking at the different services for girls and survivors of sexual violence that have been cut and impacted, including, again, safe spaces, psychosocial support. In Myanmar, we looked at the Thai-Burma border. We talked to somebody who actually saw IVs being ripped out of arms when the stop work order came down, and people having to leave hospitals. It's just, there's so much about the big data that is out there and speculation about what this will mean in the long term. But in the short term, the rollout of this policy had devastating impacts already on lives. And you know, Secretary Rubio's defiant testimony that said that lives haven't been lost, it just defies logic.
Well, let's actually talk about exactly what he said, Secretary of State Rubio, and I'd like to get your comment and also Jan Egeland, whose organization, Norwegian Refugee Council, works with aid groups and populations in need all over the world. Exactly what Rubio said before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, claiming no one has died because of USAID cuts, the cutoff of billions of dollars of U.S. support for global health programs. Another congressional hearing, he said, no children are dying on my watch. Amanda, first you, then Jan Egeland.
Again, it just defies logic. We have the estimates of the people that have been cut off from aid, cut off from life-saving care. We talked to a program in Guatemala. So you have to understand Guatemala has extraordinarily high rates of sexual violence against girls. Over 4,000 girls a year become pregnant and have very little access to abortion services, and so almost all of them carry their pregnancies to term. There was a program that provided safe nutrition and high quality food to these pregnant girls that got cut off. Now, those numbers might not come in right now in front of Secretary Rubio, but certainly the lives of these girls have been impacted. We have individual stories that when you put them all together, you see that it just is at best, it is a lack of faith to the truth. At worst, it's just outright lies.
So, Jan Egeland, how would you characterize what the U.S. Secretary of State said, Marco Rubio, when he said, no children are dying on my watch? Give us a global view, and then you just came from Mozambique. Talk about what's happening there.
My organization, Norwegian Refugee Council, works in 40 countries that is stricken by war and disasters. We're a frontline organization. And I must say, I and my frontline humanitarian works have all been very impressed with U.S. aid, the Bureau of Humanitarian Assistance, their work, and the very timely aid they have given us and multiple other organizations that are saving lives. We, in our case, give emergency relief to nearly 10 million displaced people. In northern Mozambique, which is the emergency that the world forgot, hundreds of thousands are fleeing violence from the Islamic State of Mozambique. I mean, Islamic State is defined by the U.S. and other Western countries as a very bad terror organization. On top of that, they had three cyclones in the beginning of the year, all climate-induced, climate-driven, and these are very poor people. They did nothing to cause climate change. What they see, however, is that companies from North America and from Europe are pumping gas and oil and taking precious materials, minerals from their soil. So when I then also see that the aid cuts that are going most abruptly from the US, but also other donors, but the US was 60% of humanitarian aid in this region, 60%. And then to go from 60% to zero means that the water towers in the camp I was had not been filled. This was an infrastructure paid for by American taxpayers, saving lives, because clean drinking water is life-saving. It is empty now. The latrines are overflowing. People have to relieve themselves around the camp. It would lead to epidemic disease. Some of it may spread outside of the camp, to the nation, to the region, to the world. No, it's not the way to build a railroad to take away the biggest aid program in the world. Overnight, we're working to get other nations to fill these gaps. We get aid from 40 different donor nations and international organizations. But when the biggest one leaves overnight, it really leaves a gaping hole in life-saving aid.
And what about your response, Jan Eglin, to the fact that the Trump administration maintains that life-saving aid is exempt from these cuts? What is happening in practice, though, on the ground?
Well, what is happening in reality is that they have left completely Mozambique. They have left completely Afghanistan. They have left nearly completely the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they were also the largest donor. And what we're then asking is others to step up. But again, I mean, Norway has 5.5 million inhabitants. We pay five times more per taxpayer and foreign assistance. Five times more. It's more than 1% of gross national income goes to foreign aid. 0.2% from the U.S. So it's an average nation, the U.S., in terms of what one is giving per tax. Payer. And now if U.S. is leaving international solidarity and compassion completely, they will violate every Christian ideal, every humanist ideal, every ideal of every philosophy and religion. I don't think it will happen. U.S. has traditionally been one of the more generous nations when children around the world are starving.
Well, precisely, Jan Eglin, I would like to get both of you to respond to this. The fact, the monumental improvements in both child and maternal health as a direct consequence of humanitarian aid delivered by the U.S. over the last 30 years. If you could talk about that, and then, Amanda, we'd like to get your response as well.
No, I mean, it's fantastic what the U.S. has achieved. Limiting the spread of AIDS, limiting the spread of epidemic disease, making education there for youth that have left, that had no hope, and get hope. Give one other example as well. I mean, I saw that the U.S. were giving, through the Norwegian Refugee Council, business grants to displaced families. A business grant was $260, not a very large sum, but it led the baker who had fled from Islamic State terror to a camp. He could resume becoming a baker. He has now a business. He sells 300 breads every morning, and he has employed a widow and another very poor family man to work with him. I mean, the U.S. has a lot to be proud of because of its aid. It has traditionally been in the fourth, it's been the leader of humanitarian aid, and it should remain so. We're not giving up hope to see the U.S. again coming back to the ideals that has been there for all Republican and Democratic administrations since the Second World War.
And Amanda Klasing, your response to, in particular, this issue of maternal and child health.
Yeah, absolutely. What's incredible is that the U.S. has also funded the wraparound kind of services and programs that are required to really address the drivers of maternal health. And so there have been programs and safe spaces, programs to address gender-based violence, programs to increase gender equality, programs to increase girls' education, programs to support women leaders and women human rights defenders. All of these programs that aren't necessarily health programs have led to addressing the very stubborn reasons why there continues to be high rates of maternal death in countries around the world or infant mortality. So increasing all of the quality of life issues and women's rights issues in countries around the world also address maternal mortality. And that, for sure, are the types of programs that there is no interest in returning to. And that is part of why we're so concerned that that's not going to be included.
Amanda Klassing, Amnesty International, thank you so much for joining us. And Jan Egeland in Oslo, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. And that does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. Find out more at our website, democracynow.org. Jobs. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York, joined by Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. for another edition of Democracy Now!